Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, natural disasters and the economic cycle. We'll do some baseball and we'll talk about the power grid as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 12th of November. Great to have you with us, everybody. The bad news from the Philippines continues to mount. Officials in the city of Tacloban say the death toll just in their city alone could be as high as 10,000 people. The head of the UN's Office of Humanitarian Relief has asked for $300 million as a way just to get things started over there. Obviously, there's a long way to go, but the people in the Philippines do have experience. About 20 typhoons a year hit that country, which has changed the shape of its economy. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill gets us going.
Look at a list of countries likely to get smashed by natural disasters, and the Philippines is way up there. According to an ominous-sounding index called the World Risk Report, the Philippines is the third most at-risk nation in the world, behind only the tiny island nations of Vanuatu and Tonga. Michael Beck is with the Nature Conservancy. It worked with aid groups and the UN University to produce the index.
It's right in the typhoon belt. They're also exposed to earthquakes as well.
Storm surge, sea level rise, and it's got a big and growing population, many of them poor.
This, truly is a developing nation with a lot of vulnerable people.
By some estimates, the regularity of disasters in the Philippines lowers the country's GDP nearly 1% each year. This storm will likely take a greater toll, but the economy's been growing fast, and economists doubt the typhoon will slow it down all that much. Raj Desai is a professor at Georgetown and fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says as the Philippines rebuilds, it's got to think about the future.
The best type of recovery occurs when the global foreign aid community is coordinating on what sometimes referred to as building back better.
Building back better means building with an eye to the long term.
Rebuilding through job creation, through restoring livelihoods and things like that.
A single focus on infrastructure, he says, can keep a country vulnerable next time around. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
There are reports, unofficial at this point, but reports nonetheless, that somewhere between 40 and 50,000 people have made it all the way through healthcare.gov and actually been able to buy health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Another 50,000 or so have signed up on the state exchanges, which is all well and good until you realize that the Obama administration's original plan was to have 500,000 people enrolled by now. The White House is still banking on millions being signed up by the 31st of March of 2014. So from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein asks, what happens if that doesn't happen?
If enrollment remains this anemic, it's gonna hurt.
We have enough reserves for a year, year and a half. But, 200 people in a year would be a problem.
Peter Bielenson runs Evergreen Health Co-op in Maryland. It's one of a few dozen insurance firms that was created to cash in on Obamacare. He says he needs thousands of customers to stay in business.
We have seven people that we've gotten enrolled on the exchange. At least we think we have seven people enrolled on the exchange.
It's a different story for the big boys. Their ranks of insured customers are already so big, they're not relying on the uninsured for their bottom lines. But healthcare consultant Robert Leshefsky, whose clients include the big insurers, say it's not about the cash.
Goodness, if this doesn't work, then what's the next chapter in America's political debate over healthcare reform, and how will that impact them?
Put another way, the unknown, which could include less or more government involvement in healthcare, is a lot more terrifying than microscopic enrollment numbers. Harvard health economist David Cutler says the real risk is that only the sickest and most expensive patients will bother to buy plans, creating a high-risk pool.
All high-risk pools that we have seen become stunted. Enrollment is limited, premiums are very high, costs to the government become very high.
And then the system collapses. Cutler says if that happens, that means many of the 50 million Americans who are uninsured today stay that way. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The corporate news of the day is brought to you by Commercial Aviation. U.S. Air and American Airlines have reached an agreement with the Justice Department to let their merger go ahead. There will be some selling off of landing slots, but a deal to create the world's biggest airline is basically done. On Wall Street today, fair to Midland, I'd say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Talk about the power grid, the electrical system in this country, as if it were actually a single coherent thing. Truth is, it's a patchwork of a bunch of regional networks, most of them built a very long time ago. And you can imagine what this country might look like if the grid went out for some reason, say 10 days maybe. Forget just no lights. Try no running water, no gas pumps, so no trucks, so no food supply. Tomorrow and Thursday, there's going to be a large-scale simulation of an attack on the U.S. power grid. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has a preview.
Joshua Axelrod works at Ernst & Young. He advises companies on cybersecurity for critical infrastructure, stuff like the grid. On his list of stuff we'd miss if the grid went down, national defense.
You take out a couple transformers, 18 to 24 months to replace them. Can a military installation, is it ready to run for 18 to 24 months without its, you know, external electricity provider? Probably not.
Axelrod spoke recently at a conference sponsored by the agency behind this week's drill. That's the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, NERC. Axelrod called his talk, How the Grid Will Be Hacked.
These systems have never really been designed with security in mind. We're looking at an industry that uses technology that sometimes is, you know, upwards of 20 to 30 years old and still in place. It's just not built inherently for the world that we live in.
And that's just the computer end. In the spring, a guy with a rifle damaged 5 transformers at a substation in California. And even if you're not a great shot, a lot of installations are out in the middle of nowhere and unmanned.
You can get to those locations and you can cut a lock, jump a fence, break into a control house door, and start manipulating systems.
Axelrod says the main thing that keeps the grid safe from full-scale attack, well, safe-ish, is mainly its size and complexity. Players who have the capacity to knock it out and keep it out, that's big countries like China, just don't have anything to gain. You need for that more of a James Bond supervillain type, and they haven't shown up yet. So tomorrow starts NERC's 2-day drill, the North American Grid Security Exercise 2013, GridX. There'll be more than 2,000 workers from utility companies, regulators, and law enforcement from across North America. Ted Gutierrez runs cybersecurity for the Northern Indiana Public Service Company, NIPSCO. 2 years ago, he took part in the first GridX.
A few minutes into the exercise, you forget that it's an exercise.
Gutierrez works in the most generic environment imaginable. It's this little concrete one-story office building and super dated but clean. And it's in this little campus behind a Home Depot. Across the parking lot, NIPSCO's control room gets tucked into a similar building, and Gutierrez signs me in with his colleague, Ed Gordon.
This is the critical infrastructure protected physical barrier or perimeter.
And it's a glass door.
It's a glass door.
Inside, it's a big room with dim lights and high ceilings. A 20-foot desk faces a wall full of screens, and one guy sits there at that desk, watching, clicking, answering radio calls. Another 4 or 5 people lean back at smaller desks.
That's super exciting, and we like to keep it that way.
But tomorrow, a few of these folks will get a great big jolt. The scenario for this year's GridX ups the ante from the first go-around. Brian Harrell runs GridX. He says 2011, GridX 1, just had a cyber attack. This time, you can expect stuff to actually blow up.
We don't throw in the hurricane at the last second. However, we are really trying to push ourselves to the limits.
But there is one element of a real, nationwide, long-term blackout that GridX 2 will not address. Telecommunications. In the world of the game, the internet and the phone system will keep working.
It's very difficult to run an exercise without phone lines and email, I'll be honest with you. You know, that may be something that we look at for next time.
That's GridX 3. Look for it in 2015. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The news out of Major League Baseball this week isn't off-season trades or free agent signings. The Atlanta Braves said yesterday they're going to be moving out of downtown Atlanta and into the cozy confines of a brand new stadium up in the northern suburbs, Cobb County, to be precise. The soon-to-be-abandoned Turner Field is just 17 years old, but Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed said the city can't afford the $250 million or so it would take to fix up that stadium the way the Braves want. Benjamin Flowers is an associate professor at the School of Architecture at Georgia Tech, where he specializes in the business and culture of sports stadiums. Professor Flowers, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
I have to tell you, sir, I have a car that's practically older than Turner Field, that stadium that the Braves are leaving. Have they become disposable, these multi-million dollar stadiums?
They have in very strange ways, because the team owners and franchises have realized that the real value of a stadium is not in hosting a sporting event or not even hosting more fans. In fact, you'll notice the new Falcon Stadium is projected to be smaller than the old one.
Yeah.
But rather as ways of making money. Stadiums really now are understood much in the same way skyscrapers used to be, which is as machines for generating revenue.
What's the incentive, though, for cities to spend the money they're going to spend sort of betting on the come, if you will, hoping it's going to work out when it doesn't always, as we know?
In this particular case with the Braves, I think what you're seeing is that there's a fairly well-connected real estate investment group active in Cobb County that really wants to see an anchor tenant for a much larger real estate redevelopment project at this site. And so the Braves Stadium operates much in the same way, say, Macy's would at a mall, as the kind of big anchor tenant that brings in people who then also go shopping and spending their money and spending their time elsewhere. And so I think that's what really is the driver of this particular project.
In a way, you can't blame the Braves, right? I mean, yes, they're a baseball team, an American pastime and all that, but fundamentally they're a business. They've been very vocal about saying they are moving to the heart of their fan base up in Cobb County. I mean, it's
right.
There's a rational economic reason for their decision.
There is. The argument I always say is, if you're walking down the street and there's a pile of money there, you don't say, well, I don't need this pile of money and someone else might make better use of it. You pick it up and assuming that no one else is there. Although I do think that a team that has the name of a city, and it does need to show some fealty to that geographic and urban identification.
You know, that idea of teams that have the name of the city in their names, I'm old enough to remember when the New York Giants moved to New Jersey, for crying out loud. And now we have the San Francisco 49ers moving down to Santa Clara. I mean, it's there is a lessening of affinity here, isn't there?
Well, there is, in part because the fan base, one of the things the Braves did very cleverly as a PR gesture was to put out a map showing a red dot for every Braves ticket purchased in 2012. And you will see that the fan base for the franchise currently draws predominantly from the northern wealthier suburbs than it does from inside the city and the southern suburbs. And of course, there's also a racial divide that is described.
It's whiter up there. I mean, that's a little touchy, but it's a whiter neighborhood.
It is, exactly. And so I think part of what happens is we're seeing an overall gentrification of sporting life and sporting culture in the United States, where essentially the idea of baseball as a working class and middle class pastime to play and as a working class and middle class pastime to observe is being transformed into a culture where really we're talking about the teams and the franchises care most about the high spenders, the high rollers, the big ticket buyers and the luxury box owners than they do about the $5 and $10 seat ticket holder.
Benjamin Flowers at the School of Architecture at Georgia Tech. Professor, thanks very much for your time, sir.
You're very welcome.
Coming up,
what is a blue chip company?
It's a company that makes those blue tortilla chips they sell at fancy markets.
No, it's not. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 32 points today, 0.2%, closed at 15,750, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ traded flat 39.19, the S&P 500 drifted down 5 points, 0.3%, 1766 at the bell. News that the merger of U.S. Airways and AMR was cleared for takeoff gave airline stocks a lift. AMR soared 25%. Today, United Continental skipped up 4%. Delta banked 2.25% higher. Big Oil got a little bit smaller today as crude prices fell. Chevron dribbled down 1%. ExxonMobil slipped a third of 1%. ConocoPhillips emptied 1% as well today. Bond prices, well, they fell. Glad you asked. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.77%. And you're listening to Market Place.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for October. Macy's reports quarterly earnings. And on November 13th, 1927, the Holland Tunnel connecting Manhattan and Jersey City opened to traffic. It was the first mechanically ventilated underwater vehicular tunnel. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Healthy eating and exercise are yesterday's news at the White House, it seems. Today, Michelle Obama said she's got a new project, higher education, getting more low-income students to graduate from college, to be precise. It can be a valuable thing to have the First Lady interested in a cause, but how valuable exactly? Well, here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
When the First Lady picks an issue, it's like a celebrity endorsement.
Like a celebrity endorsement, it can draw public attention.
Karen Petru is a Washington-based economist.
Because it is from the White House, it also tends to come with significant policy implications.
And those implications aren't always positive. Remember the backlash when Hillary Clinton took on health care reform?
The view that First Lady should stick to ladylike issues. Health care was a little too macho for the public taste.
Michelle Obama's issues, exercise, healthy eating, and now college education, are all suitably non-macho. Jared Bernstein was a member of the president's economic team. He says the public loves this first lady.
We used to say around the White House, if you did something that was going to be really popular, you'd say, wow, you're going to get Michelle numbers with that.
Bernstein says in addition to being popular, Michelle Obama is also a very persuasive spokesperson and person.
I remember once I was in line at the White House mess and I was going to get a cookie and she walks up and I decided to get an apple. So just, you know, having her there makes a difference.
But that doesn't mean more kids will go to college, says Bernstein. Take the Just Say No anti-drug movement backed by Nancy Reagan. It got tons of press, but studies found that students who were exposed to Just Say No were just as likely or even more likely to use drugs. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Here's another what's it worth question. The good old-fashioned apology. The White House, all the way up to and including the president, has been apologizing for the failures of Obamacare. CBS News has said it's sorry for its flawed 60 Minutes report on Benghazi. All of which means what exactly? Kate Davidson has that story.
Davia Temin runs a crisis and reputation management firm for businesses. So she's pretty good at spotting the faux-pology.
That goes something like, I'm so sorry you feel that way.
Remember when the CEO of Abercrombie & Fitch said he only markets to cool, attractive people? Well, years later, he was still regretting that his words were interpreted in a manner that caused offense. Temin says businesses also mess up apologies by going into denial.
We really didn't do that, did we? If we did do it, it really wasn't that bad, was it?
In medicine, more than 30 states now have laws that make it easier for doctors to say, I'm sorry, while making those apologies inadmissible in court. Some hospitals have reported that as transparency about medical errors goes up and safety improves, lawsuits go down. Bioethicist Art Kaplan says people are receptive to a doctor saying, I'm sorry, my hand slipped.
That's a terrible thing, but it might be excused. If you say, I apologize, I came in drunk, apologies don't get you very far.
But presidential apologies are tricky. Political science professor Graham Dodds points to what critics called Obama's apology tour, the new president's effort to mend fences in Europe and the Middle East.
A lot of his critics, conservative critics especially, just thought this was terrible. The U.S. should never, ever apologize. You stand your ground, you never say sorry.
And in fact, Obama didn't actually say I'm sorry back then. It took the healthcare mess for him to do that now. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
This is, as we've said a whole bunch of times on this broadcast, a credit-driven economy, both big picture on Wall Street and in the banking system. but also for individuals. So if you've never owned a house, let's say, or had a loan, it's hard to get a credit score, let alone actual credit, which helps explain why there's a bill pending in Congress right now to let would-be borrowers use cell phone bills or rent and utility payments to establish a credit track record. Peter O'Dowd has a real-life example.
Marco Meraz knows what it's like to be ignored by a bank.
This is our first venture into the restaurant industry, so we're novice entrepreneurs, and it definitely requires a lot of patience.
Meraz owns Republica Empanada in downtown Mesa, Arizona. His deep fryer is bubbling over with crispy papas fritas. He's long had dreams of opening this Latin restaurant, but with a single credit card to his name and no experience running a business, the bank wouldn't give him a loan.
That wasn't an option for us. We had to find alternative means to finance this project.
That alternative was a $20,000 line of credit through a local neighborhood economic development group. Meraz finally started slinging empanadas this summer. But if his credit report had included years of on-time cell phone and utility payments,
it would have allowed us to open the restaurant about a year and a half sooner. That's a big difference.
I think there's a lot of pitfalls along the way here.
Mike Sullivan is among the skeptics. He's a credit expert at Take Charge America, a nonprofit that provides credit counseling.
Can you even make the statement that somebody who pays their rent and pays their water bill is also going to pay their credit card bill? I don't think that's been proven yet.
Plus, Sullivan says credit reports are already full of mistakes, and disputing an inaccurate score is a bureaucratic nightmare.
So making it more complex isn't going to improve that situation, and so it's going to probably hurt a few additional consumers because their credit isn't correct.
Reporting rent and utility payments would still be voluntary under this bill, and credit agencies already do this on a limited basis. Equifax, for instance, manages a database of 70 telecom, cable TV, and utility companies. But don't expect your local utility to automatically jump on board.
I don't necessarily believe that it needs to be legislated.
Renee Castillo works for a power and water utility that serves nearly a million people in Metro Phoenix. Her company, the Salt River Project, does report severely delinquent accounts to collection agencies, but SRP won't punish customers every time a monthly payment is missed.
Power is something that people need, and there are things that happen in people's lives, and we have programs and services that help them to become current on their bill and not to have a problem.
And this is a point that opponents of the bill will make. In hard times, a few missed utility payments could bring down a credit score a lot faster than years of paying on time. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
We talk, sometimes literally, sometimes indirectly, about winners and losers in the economy pretty much every day on this program. Today, two guys who wrote the book on winning, sort of literally, Daniel Kibblesmith and Sam Weiner, are the authors of the new satirical advice book, How to Win at Everything. Here with their tips for winning on Wall Street.
Playing the stock market is no get-rich-quick scheme, but it is a foolproof wealth-generating strategy that will help you get rich and quick.
That's right, Sam. The keen investor watches companies closely to determine whether to buy, sell, or hold their stocks. For instance, if a little-known tech startup invents an algorithm that lets you smell new babies over the internet.
Buy. When an auto manufacturer is forced to recall a car that blows up when the driver is sad.
Sell. Let's say a struggling financial firm introduces a new chief financial officer that's just a big bag of money wearing expensive-looking glasses.
Hold. And that's especially true of blue-chip companies.
What is a blue-chip company?
It's a company that makes those blue tortilla chips they sell at fancy markets.
Now, this one is entirely hypothetical.
Could never happen.
But imagine a soft drink company releases a groundbreaking advertisement featuring hip, diverse 20-somethings enjoying themselves.
Buy immediately. An advertisement that revolutionary. I can't even imagine what it would look like.
Do they all know each other?
Where did this multi-ethnic group of friends even meet?
Now, buy, sell, or hold.
If oil company executives circulate a desperate, hand-drawn map revealing a hidden cache of oil in the moon?
Sell.
Fast food conglomerate cuts costs by replacing genuine sour cream with nothing.
told.
A pharmaceutical company invents sexually transmitted cancer just to see if they could.
Sell, sell, sell.
And finally, after tragedy, Chief Financial Officer Bag of Money's steadfast son is installed as the new CFO, vowing to be, quote, an even bigger bag of money with even more money in it.
Bye.
Following our stock tips, you'll be a millionaire in no time. All that's left is to rake it in, literally, by raking your money into piles and paying a group of orphans to cry as you burn it in front of them.
And remember, whoever said money can't buy happiness was obviously a rich person lying to a crowd of poor people.
Daniel Kibble-Smith and Sam Weiner are the authors of How to Win at Everything.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which we at long last find a marketplace angle to the news out of Toronto and its crack-smoking mayor, Rob Ford. There was in Toronto City Hall today what was reported to be a crowd of hundreds of people lined up to buy, wait for it now, it's going to be a good one, Rob Ford bobblehead dolls. $20 a whack for what are being called Robbie Bobbies. I kid you not, proceeds to the United Way. So that's good. Anyway. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow off 32 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ was flat. The S&P 500 down 5 points, about 0.3% there. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Candice Manriquez are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.